This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. 2 years after the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, that sparked a rebellion nationwide calling for Black Lives to Matter, a new report has found that when comparing the wealth of Black families to white families, that it would take hundreds of years for African Americans to catch up. Wealth and income levels are intimately linked to educational and health outcomes. The report is entitled The Ever-Growing Gap. Without change, African-American and Latino families won't match white wealth for centuries. It's a collaboration between CFED, the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative, and the Institute for Policy Studies. Joining me now is co-author of the report, Chuck Collins. He's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org, and his forthcoming book is Born on Third Base, a one percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. Welcome to the program, Chuck.
Good to be with you, Sonali.
So let's first clarify, your report looks specifically at wealth rather than just income. Wealth, as I understand it, is essentially something that is a generational thing that gets passed down from one generation to the other. How do you define wealth, and why look at wealth rather than income?
Well, wealth is what you own minus what you owe. And it's important because if you think income is what you have on an annual basis, but wealth is really what you have to fall back on in the event of an emergency or a job loss or and in a way, wealth is where the past shows up in the present. Wealth is where we see the imprint of racial discrimination and asset building show up in people's bank accounts or lack of savings. And so it's a much more important indicator in some ways than income.
And so we know, of course, if we are aware of from the history of this country, where those racial divides originate, particularly when we talk about African Americans, whose origin in this country stemmed from being enslaved en masse and never having a full reconciliation that took into account economic justice. But we also have, the report also looks at Latino households in terms of the origin of the racial wealth divide there. That also is rooted in history, whether you're talking about, native-born Latinos who've been here for generations or newly arrived. But what is the reason why the racial wealth gap that has its origins in American history persists so strongly?
Well, if you think about it, even if we just go back, say, two generations to after World War II and the sort of the U.S. government was in the business of promoting homeownership through, billions of dollars of subsidies for low-interest loans that went primarily to white households. So millions of white households got on the express train to wealth building, and Blacks and Latinos were sort of barred, kept at the station, standing at the station, not able to get on that train. So then here we are, 60 years later, 80 years later, we start to see some of those imprints are still there. The home ownership rate for whites is 72%. The home ownership rates for Blacks is 41%. For Latinos, 43%. So that gap in home ownership, we can trace directly back to subsidized home ownership. So those are examples. We can look at discrimination and other kinds of asset building, retirement funds, et cetera. But those are the way that's where the past is showing up in the present.
So as we look at wealth across the board, isn't it true that wealth is increasing for all households? It's the rate at which it increases for different communities that matters as well?
Yes. I mean, what we did was we looked at between 1983 and 2013 using Federal Reserve information. And it's true that everybody's wealth grew, Black wealth, Latino wealth, and white wealth. If we look at average wealth, by the way, if we looked at median wealth, actually median Black wealth did not grow. But we are looking at a more conservative number, which is the average, which includes the wealth of the most wealthy in every group. And so that tends to pull that average up. But our point is, even with wealth rising, average wealth rising, the pace at which it rises is very different. So in the last 30 years, the racial wealth divide has continued to grow. And we're basically saying, look, let's look forward. if wealth inequality grows at the same rate into the future, how long would it take an African American to achieve the same level of white wealth that whites have today? And we found it would take 228 years for African Americans to attain the same, at the growth rate of the last 30 years, the same level of white wealth. And it would take Latinos 84 years. Our point is not to say we want white wealth to stagnate over the next century. It's that's just to sort of dramatize how slowly that gap is actually closing.
And so, Chuck, if the rates remain the same, the rates of wealth growth remain the same, that white wealth grows at its rate and black wealth and Latino wealth grows at its rate, will we see a divergence? Does white wealth rise much faster? That if action isn't taken now, that racial wealth divide just keeps growing and growing and growing?
Yes, and we looked ahead 30 years. So if the next 30 years is sort of the same rates of growth as the last 30 years, say by 2043, when, according to the U.S. Census, people of color will be the majority in this country, the racial wealth gap will be almost $1 million in net worth between average whites and average Latinos and blacks. It will double. So that's the trajectory. And so left to its own devices on autopilot, that's where we're heading. And I think our report is an attempt to say, let's wake up. That's, we don't want to head in that direction. That's not good for anybody. That's that we're essentially going to create, a white hereditary aristocracy of wealth in this country. The French economist Thomas Piketty was sort of warned, hey, look, we're moving toward creating an aristocracy of wealth, hereditary wealth and power. That's where we're heading. The sons and daughters of today's billionaires will be, ruling our country. He neglected to say that will be a white hereditary aristocracy. That's where we're going unless we intervene.
Chuck, let's throw out some numbers. Some of the numbers in your report kind of, shocked me. I mean, for example, just current average household wealth in 2013 for African Americans is something like $85,000 a year. So we're talking $85,000. So we're talking about average household wealth. For whites, it's in the hundreds of thousands.
That's right. Yeah. And again, think of that as an average. So you're in the case of whites, we are averaging in, the Forbes 400, which is almost entirely white people. So there's a white concentration of wealth that brings that number up. But it's almost $500,000 is the average white net worth. And by 2043, that average net worth would be $1.2 million if we basically maintain the same trajectory.
And explain the Forbes 400. I mean, these are basically what, the 400 wealthiest people in the country?
Right. So we also thought, part of what we're saying is that there's an inequality trend and there's a racial wealth dynamic trend, that these inequalities where more and more wealth is funneling to the top are part of what's supercharging the racial wealth divide. So, the 400 wealthiest billionaires in this country have, they over that 30-year period, their wealth grew 726%, just, taking out inflation. Over 700% growth in the wealth of the Forbes 400. And, the wealthiest 100 billionaires in the United States now have as much wealth as the entire African-American population. So we think it's important to say, yes, there's a racial wealth divide, but part of what's going on is there's just this extreme shift of wealth to the very, very top, and that's kind of exacerbating and making worse the racial wealth divide.
Now, Chuck, your report focuses primarily on the racial wealth divide between white households and black households, between white and Latino households. But you do have a footnote on Asian American and Pacific Islander households and also Native American households, two starkly disparate groups when it comes to wealth. Can you just give us a little sense of where those two communities are with respect to wealth?
I wish we knew more. I mean, what we have, we are actually went back to 1983, which that's actually where the best data begins for Latinos. It goes back further a little bit for African Americans. Data on Asians is very hard to disaggregate because within the Asian population, you have immigrants from South Asia, you have Chinese immigrants, you have overall, rates of wealth growth for Asians that are actually growing faster than whites. But we actually know that if we were to pull apart and sort of look at the experience of different ethnic groups within the Asian race category, it would be very, very different. So it's hard to get a good story or explanation there. Same with Native Americans. The data sample is so small, but we know that that is not a group that's seeing any significant increase in assets.
Let's talk about what can be done to tackle this. I mean, for example, the Movement for Black Lives has, and even some unions, we had Andy Stern on our show recently. There's some move towards adopting a universal basic income that some say would go a long way towards, you know, addressing, or maybe just a part way towards addressing the racial wealth divide. But I can only imagine the kind of political, fight there would be over such an issue. Are there other ways to tackle this issue, to say, all right, if we can't just leave things the way they are, that might be politically achievable?
Well, you know, we sort of have three basic recommendations in our report. One is just to do a racial wealth divide audit of existing policy. People will often say, well, let's promote home ownership. Well, depends how we promote home ownership in terms of will it actually reduce the wealth divide. So we think an evidence-based analysis of what policies actually are having an effect of reducing the racial wealth divide would be
right, because we have the subprime mortgage crisis come out of this drive to increase home ownership, right?
Exactly. And, you know, the dynamics that are creating inequality overall and the dynamics that create the racial wealth divide both overlap, but there's some really important differences. And even, you know, you will have, you know, good people with good intention will say, well, here's the program to reduce the racial wealth divide. But it's not, you know, home ownership, homes do not appreciate the same in different neighborhoods. Home ownership is not the answer in every case. The second thing, though, that I think is kind of encouraging is we actually, as a society, spend a tremendous amount of money helping people build wealth and assets. There are all kinds of tax incentives for retirement funds, for investing and saving, and for home ownership, and for putting aside money for future college education. All those are in the form of tax breaks for people who do that. And those tax incentives are, we've spent $8 trillion over the last 20 years promoting wealth creation. In 2015 alone, we spent $660 billion. The problem is that those subsidies are completely upside down. They basically help the already have wealth folks and do very little to help people who are currently excluded from asset building and wealth. So for instance, the home mortgage interest deduction, you know, a $200 billion annual subsidy, most of that goes to multimillionaires who have multiple houses. So it's essentially a mansion subsidy. We could reform that, cap that, and redirect. Our position is let's redirect these asset building programs to people who have been systematically excluded from wealth building. That could be Blacks and Latinos, but also segments of the white population and others who have not been able to get on the wealth building train for various reasons. That's where we should be aiming that $660 billion a year, not to those who already have substantial wealth.
Right. And we also, of course, know that those who can afford to hire really good tax lawyers know how to exploit every existing loophole that is available to them, whereas the rest of ordinary Americans might even miss some of the subsidies that might be available to them. What about, I mean, I know this is always a sort of a politically charged issue, but a lot of folks say we've never fully come to terms with our history of slavery, where, you know, wouldn't the issue of, say, reparations go such a long way towards tackling the racial wealth divide, particularly for African Americans? I don't know if that's an issue that you discuss in your report, but certainly, you know, it should be raised.
I think that it's the only way I can make sense of the way forward here, which is we need to have some form of reparations. One, just because as a society, we have to acknowledge this history. It's sort of like floating out there that we're still some kind of meritocracy. We're trying to create a level playing field. You hear that language, starting gate equality. When we're talking about multiple generations of wealth, you know, a legacy of racism and wealth building. going back to slavery, obviously, the ultimate dispossession. So I think we have to have a conversation about reparations. Ta-Nehisi quotes, has a nice quote. He says, it's the price we pay to see ourselves squarely. So that's part of it, is just owning our history. But then there's this actual financial wealth there. My co-author, Diedrich Muhammad, and I have this idea. It's, imagine we're all playing poker together. There's six of us sitting there and we're playing poker. And all of a sudden we realize that two of us playing in the poker game have been getting extra cards. And so we have this tremendous advantage in the game for the first hour. And so it's like, okay, well, let's play with a new deck. We'll play with a better deck. Let's play with the new rules. And then the question is, what do we do about all those chips, those poker chips that are in front of the folks who've been winning with the rigged deck? I think one concrete thing is we should all press for a passage of H.R. 40, which is the Reparations Commission, to look at reparations for slavery and to come up with some ways in which we can transfer wealth and create wealth building opportunities. I think it's going to look similar to what we're proposing here, which is let's target home ownership and savings incentives for people who've been excluded. But it should be done in the context of a national discussion about reparations.
And then I think higher education is such an important issue as well. On this notion that we live in a meritocracy, even if that were true, we have a crisis today of college loans and debt that has burdened young people, particularly young people of color who are, you know, enrolling or would like to enroll in universities and colleges at increasing rates, who then graduate with these in huge burdens, huge debt burdens, only to find a job market without enough jobs or jobs that are poorly paid. I can only imagine, I mean, when you have wealthy households whose parents can afford to pay entirely for college, that the racial wealth divide really comes into play when it comes to the ability of white parents to put their kids through college versus black or Latino parents to put their kids through college. That is also an important issue, right?
Absolutely. That's a great way that what you described is an example of how advantages are now compounding for people at the top. I would argue like the top 10% of households are the ones who are able to actually really help their children in terms of access to higher education, debt-free education, and they're propelling their kids, you know, at a faster pace. I think the answer there is both a universal debt-free education, you know, like tax inherited wealth and create a debt-free college education fund, a tuition-free education fund, starting with public universities and state universities. But then I think we also have to address the historic barriers to access. I mean, after World War II, there was a GI Bill for education. It was supposedly universal, and some African Americans and famous African Americans like Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier took advantage of the GI Bill to get a debt-free education. But for most African Americans and most Latinos, that was not the situation. They were excluded from the debt-free education opportunities. And so we should do something that's in a sense of repair or reparation for that. There should be a special pool that also increases access for those traditionally excluded by institutional racism. So I think there are a lot of young white people, obviously, who are also taking on huge amounts of college debt. It's just a bad situation overall. So we should do something to create universal tuition-free education and then also deal with the historic inequalities as well, I think.
Chuck, where can people get a hold of this report that you co-authored?
Maybe the easiest place is to go to inequality.org, which is a website that we run at the Institute for Policy Studies, and you'll see it right on the homepage. And that'll connect you to a landing page that has some of the media coverage about the report, as well as the report and its findings.
That's inequality.org. Chuck, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
Chuck Collins is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. Again, that website is inequality.org, and we've been talking about a report that he co-authored on the racial wealth divide. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.